Thank you, everybody. Sorry to break up. I'm just saying it's very hard to break up conversations, and everybody's very engaged, so sorry to do that. And I hope that you'll have and take more opportunities continue. We've got half an hour before lunch, so it's a nice opportunity for us to have a group discussion. And so we'd be very interested to hear any comments or questions that came from your conversation in your small groups. So who's going to be the first one? You, please, oh, Bettina, you can encourage.
We briefly discussed that we really, or that your idea of returning resonates, and that the implicit model of doing critique is often becoming separate and closely connected to the separate autonomous individual who makes a critical decision to leave. Mm-hmm. And that your insistence on returning was something that seemed to be very well resonate with us.
Thank you. That's great that you picked that up, because yes, that is fundamental, and both Te Kauiho and I have talked about that in terms of the idea of relationship. It is a return, it is an engagement, it's a committed engagement. I remember when I first told my head of school many, many years ago that as a Pākehā I had made a conscious decision to move from my feminist theory work into Indigenous relational work. And she tried to discourage me because she said, your work will never be your own. So the idea that I might be, she understood at some level that I was moving away from, inevitably, not consciously, but inevitably away from that autonomy, the individualized academic, the entrepreneurial academic, into some relationships that I could never escape. I mean, I could, but it would be pretty hard in New Zealand. I'd probably have to leave the country. But yes, they are relationships that are enduring, and that there is some accountability to me from those people that I work with as well. So it's that's not easy. It's not a simple decision, but it is. It's a constant return, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for picking that up. I really like that.
Yeah, so thank you so much. So I have maybe a weird thought. well, let me see how to phrase this. So it's as far as you showed us, this question of relating is at the very core, and this is what we hope for, of course. And I learned that I'm not even a Pākehā, so that makes a lot of sense. So I'm not connected into this history of guilt. I have another history of guilt in this country, right? And it's interesting, to what extent could we, and this is a question that formulation that I would revise, could we understand the Kaupapa Māori, which is maybe wrong because we would have to connect. So how could we connect to Kaupapa Māori as non-Pākehā, so to say, so that we not just learn about that in a way that we could use the concepts in a way, but relate to that. And I think that maybe this thinking and perceiving and knowledging or so is of course related to the land, or I guess so very much so. Mm. So and this of course the question that's there on the board, how could we relate to this? And I think, and this is the weird part of that, I think this is what you're doing, and thank you so much for taking all the efforts for coming here. This is a kind of gift that you're giving us. So, and what I've learned, on a different Indigenous conference, is that receiving a gift comes with a responsibility. So, how can we build up this kind of responsibility, and in order to learn? And I think this is something. There's something that should that has to happen in order for us to learn in a different way than we usually do on only the level of concept. So, and I think it has to do with giving something back. And you sang a song for us, but we don't have a song. So, so what's on that place? So that's just my question. So, and I hope we would find some ways to answer this question. But in a way, I guess I think we on the side, if you don't know the context here, besides the Schwarzwald, the Black Hood, yeah, then I think it's important to learn about where we stand here and maybe why are we here in this place and what are our hopes having you here. So and I think I can only talk for myself. So I would say there's a kind of desperation with regard to this extreme individualism and the outcomes we have, simply so. And we have our own traditions of thinking, for example, in philosophy, in Germany especially, like the romantic philosophy, romanticism, which is all about interrelatedness and the thinking that something like mind and spirit is really nature coming to itself, reflecting itself. But we lost that, for example, right? So there's a kind of desperation about that. That's all I can give.
Well, thank you for that. I don't just think you're on the right track with that line of questioning and thinking. When we first started speaking to Bettina, we were very perplexed as to why the interest in kaupapa Māori, like what does this have to do with you, and even this is not for you, I think we said. You know, and it is difficult to think how it might, you know, how a relationship might be forged. I do think that, you know, you're probably all familiar with sort of decolonial and decolonising approaches and the way in which you can show solidarity through your, you know, utilisation of, you know, your engagement with that work. But it is a different thing to, you know, engage with, you know, Indigenous thinking and concepts in a decontextualised way. And it's very difficult to, I mean, we've seen that and we've seen it done very badly, you know. So, I mean, I think it's not to say you shouldn't, but of course it requires, I mean, a consideration of all the things I think you know about. You know, it's not like, oh, here's a new theory on the block, let's grab some of that and, you know, bung it into our next academic paper. You know, because as you've all said, this is another colonial gesture. So I think it is just a slow process of just sitting with some of these ideas, you know, just reading and just, you know, as you say, kind of how do these ideas resonate with some perhaps of our own, you know, deep and long kind of history and some maybe, I don't know, some concepts that have gone out of fashion, but, you know, actually are resonant. And how do, you know, some of those concepts maybe bear some relationship and difference to some of the concepts here. But I think what we're talking about relates to, you know, to methodology too, how we do research. You know, I mean, Māori people have hated research and researchers because they just, you know, when researchers have come into Māori communities, more in the past than now, but even now, and even Māori are guilty of this, you know, you're there to extract something from those people. And, you know, Māori have thought, well, where have our friends gone? You know, you finish your research, bye. And, you know, those communities are still saying, oh, we haven't seen you, where have you been? Because that was a friendship, that was a relationship of trust. And so how across space and, you know, very different cultural contexts can we hold on to those ideas in our engagement?
Yeah. You know, often what, as I was saying before, what's left for us is solidarity with them. You know, that's how we think about solidarity. I have some political solidarity. But how does that, what does that actually mean? Does it mean that we give money to an Indigenous organisation? Does it mean that we educate our students about colonial histories? Does it mean that we become knowledgeable about Indigenous theories? to what extent does that then affect our practices and our thinking? And it, you know, these post-humanist, new materialist approaches that have a kind of developing an ontology of, you know, post-humanism, that's a whole field that resonates quite strongly with some of the ideas of, you know, an Indigenous perspective. And it seems to me, what you were saying before, that there within your own cultural heritage, there is a lot to be mined, there's a lot to be had, but it does require a kind of stepping out of the academic, you know, reverence for theory and the theorist, the kind of clean theorist, because of course theory is a great refuge. It's so clean, it's so tidy, it's so predictable. We can control it. You get involved in Indigenous work, very messy, distressing sometimes, frustrating, all of those things. It's kind of almost like the opposite of having a theory-based relationship with your work. And so many people choose not to do that, and I think we can understand, but if you're committed to that and want to do that, that's the direction, I guess, that, you know, those are the kinds of things that you might think further about. I don't know. But that's a great point that you raise. Important. Yeah.
I have a question on the concrete level, because I really like to think in metaphors, and I really can well connect to the idea of friendship, for example, with the work of Hannah Arendt, Friendship in Dark Times. These kind of thinkings I really like. But for me, the point in your talking was that it's maybe kind of a deep listening process, but I would really like to hear what it could mean on a concrete example level, and maybe that is something we discussed on in our group, the continuity in this kind of process. What? Because it was a bit a question, how is it framed in your work? So this might be maybe a sort of connection to our discussion. Thank you.
A deep listening. Are you thinking about learning from being in an Indigenous context? Can you explain a little bit, or somebody else explain a little bit your question? A concrete example.
A concrete example of those processes you described, where you have to stay in kind of a friendship, and what does it mean? What? So, on an abstract level, I really like the idea you described, but I cannot grasp it yet. That's my point.
Well, I mean, Alison can speak from her perspective, but I suppose from a, you know, there's a series of writings by some Māori leaders from Ngata was writing Ngā Hoa Aroha.
Oh, yes.
There's a series of writings between Māori leaders and colonial officials, I suppose, from the 1800s. And those were always signed by the Māori person, your loving friend. You know, your loving friend, which is very interesting. So this is a kind of an idea, you know, a relational idea about how relationships work. If they're not directly kin relationships, then they're a relationship of friendship. Now, in the kind of, I suppose, the contemporary, hyper-politicised context of our worlds, I mean, Māori people I'm one of them, are saying, you know, calling, say, my colleagues into engagement with Māori thinking and so on, and relationships with us in the university. On the other hand, we're saying, be careful about cultural taxation, you know, this kind of constant desire and want to know and demand for attention and demand for recognition and demand for knowledge from Indigenous people and scholars. And so I guess, you know, this, when we think about what friendship can be. You know, there's reciprocity, and it might be quite a different kind of set of relationships with Indigenous people than you might have with non-Indigenous colleagues. I know Alison, for example, has done quite a lot of writing with Indigenous colleagues where she has written and really done most of the writing work, because those colleagues are involved in, you know, all manner of other things, fighting fires and doing tribal work and whatever else. Those colleagues have contributed interesting ideas. But that was, you know, I guess that's an example of how that relationship can work. You know, it's the kind of the support for your friend in their career is one way that reciprocity and that relationship can occur. I mean, you might have other things to
say. I think there are lots of concrete examples I can think of at different levels. If I'm thinking about teaching, working with a group of colleagues, an aspect of friendship relationship or friendly relationship in New Zealand is that we in New Zealand use Māori language correctly. Now, that might seem very, very simple and banal, but in New Zealand, Pākehā people say Māori words incorrectly and always have. They don't pronounce the words correctly, which shows a kind of disrespect or lack of friendship towards the language and the people. So just the very act of changing the way we speak in order to say Māori words correctly in our everyday lives, that is a step towards. It is not an ignoring, it is a step towards. That's one number one platform, very, very small. But in New Zealand, that is highly significant. And if you hear a Pākehā person speaking and using Māori language or Māori words, and they are correctly pronounced, there is a sense of engagement already. So that's just a tiny step. And then it moves through to other things. For example, we've had controversies in the university about, like this morning, we did our karakia, which is as Te Kawiho said, it's not a prayer as such, it's not Christian, but it is a kind of spiritual moment. It's calling together all the spiritual, emotional forces that are here that we want to bring into some kind of intentional focus. And we've brought some of those ways of being into our faculty meetings. And there are some colleagues who say, this is a secular institution. We don't want anything to do with spirituality. No, we will not do this. But the majority of the staff recognise, in terms of this vast set of possibilities in the relationship, that is just one more step. And it's not simply performative, you know, it's not simply, oh, we'll do it because they want it. It actually becomes part of who we are and how we are. So that is that kind of listening, being. The friendship is moving towards, in a way that is meeting, you know, towards a meeting. And that can move all the way through, you know, to co-authorship, things that can be political support for actions. It can be not standing in the way of something that's happening. You know, there are a range of practical examples, I think, that we encounter.
I'll just say one thing, Deb, and then you go ahead. There's a concept in the Māori world called he kano he kitia, the seen face. And so that, the seen face is, I see your face. You turn up. You know, you come and visit me. You call me. When we have, you know, ceremonies or welcomes and various things on marae in the university or anywhere, you're there, you're there, you're helping, you're putting out the chairs, you're, you know, you're singing the song, you're present, you're showing your support by turning up and continuing to turn up. And so there's a lot of people who, academics in our university, who will write with solidarity, you know, for the Māori cause, but you will never see them. You don't know them, they don't turn up, they don't make themselves known to you, they don't try and form a friendship with you. So I think that's kind of maybe at the core of you know, just the turning up, the return, all of those discussions.
Kia ora. In Kororarika, where I'm domiciled, so when I moved home and my cousin asked me to be the co-chair of the marae, and as soon as I arrived, she left. And I suddenly realised that what we had were Pākehā on our committee, and I said to her, hey, what's going on here? It's not just us, it's Pākehā. And she said, well, actually, if you think about Kororarika, that was the foundational relationship place for a bicultural country before the signing of Te Tiriti. So all the negotiation was happening over in Kororarika. So we have this marae committee, which requires some dissonance, a point of tension between how we interpret an Indigenous culture working alongside Pākehā. So part and parcel of that is really about the Pākehā who are on board. They don't interfere in the tikanga Māori and the practices that we have, although they will support them. But if anything is of a cultural context, they will encourage but sit back. And if they don't sit back, if they have a comment about that, that's okay, it's listened to, but generally we will respond to it. I try not to react because there's a differentiation between reacting and responding. In terms of the friendship process, we try to respond to them. But it's with that dissonance and an understanding that actually we're all working in the same way to get to the end, because it's like we know that the mokopuna coming through, whether they're Pākehā, Māori, you know, because it's a bicultural relationship, not a multicultural, it's us and everybody else. And so it requires us to have some emotional intelligence in a way that actually corresponds with everyone else who wants to comment about our culture in a way that actually is uplifting and, you know, says, well, most of the Pākehā say, well, I'm not going there, Deb, because that's yours too, but if you want the support, then we're here. We stand behind you, we stand alongside of you, and we're there for whatever you need. And really, that's the partnership, you know, I would say in the context of what we're doing in Kororarika is what we want and what both Te Kawiho and Alison are alluding to. In a practical way, you know, how does the theory become a practical application? And that's it. We're all working with it, and we're going to have some disagreements. That's a given. We're human beings. But, you know, we're all in it together.
Yeah, thank you for sharing or letting us share these ideas. I understand very well, I get an idea of how you interact, how you develop knowledge, but I still want to know what you said, we interact, we listen, but and you were talking about Maori ontologies, concepts, ideas. You said you acquire them by listening, by developing, but to whom? Are these ideas in the community? Are there wise people? Are there particular places? So maybe that's an academic question, but you said we're allowed to ask any questions.
Absolutely.
So how?
And I think that one thing you might not be familiar with is in New Zealand, there are many contexts that are Maori contexts. So Deb was just mentioning the marae, which is these days is a large meeting house, a space where there are often meetings or weddings or funerals, a range of activities and all sorts of things. And we have a marae at our university campus. It's our university marae as well. So there are plenty of opportunities for us to be there when there are discussions, seminars, events of all sorts. And in those situations, we can learn through our skin, through our ears, through our spirit being there. And so that's one of the places, but also in the context of the classroom, in the office, a range of places. Remember that in New Zealand, Māori are about 17% of the population. So there are significant presence of Māori in politics and in education. So there are many, many opportunities for us to interact. And you talk about wise people. And there are many knowledge holders, yes, who will be engaging and leading and guiding all these situations. Yes. And these are knowledge holders, you know. It's, yeah. Sorry, I jumped
in. Our knowledge holders are kind of growing all the time because kaupapa Māori education and Māori language education is probably 35, 40 yes. years. And so we've got generations of young people who now are deeply proficient in Māori language, culture, knowledge, history, and so on. So there are very few settings in New Zealand anymore that you can go to, like a, you know, community meeting or whatever, something at a school or anywhere really, where Māori aren't present and where Māori cultural practices aren't a feature of the of those settings. So there's a lot of engagement. There's a lot of sites of engagement. They're every day. Mm.
What do you do if there's dissent? If somebody says this is Māori knowledge and somebody says no, it's not Māori. I mean, does this exist? Do you have situations like that? And if somebody says this is not Māori knowledge, it's something else.
Yep.
How do you deal with it? By discussion or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's. I mean, I think Māori knowledge is sort of not singular. There's, you know, there's some foundational big ontological ideas and practices that we all agree on, but you know. Tribal histories are very much alive and well, and so you from your tribe have an account of this part of our shared history, and I have another account, and your account is okay and my account is okay, and we can get up and debate it and we can talk about it and we can laugh about it, but at the end of the day my account is not trying to dominate your account. They can both sort of sit alongside each other. But we do argue, you know, we do argue and debate, and we're talking about in the context of our university developing Māori knowledge pathways through the university, in particular for Māori students, but for potentially for other students, because you know, as I just said, we've got these generations of Māori students who can speak Māori and think Māori and all of that, and so they come into the very white university. You know, predominantly, and what they have to leave their culture and language at the door. So we're having conversations about how can we make sure that that Māori knowledge that is brought into the university or produced in the university is reliable knowledge, and that the people who are presenting it and teaching it are reliable as well. So we are having those conversations among ourselves in a range of settings.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and I can give a slightly different answer in terms of, you know, there's debates amongst Māori in terms of knowledge about knowledge, but then there's also Pākehā comments about Māori things. And I'll give you an example to my own disadvantage. When I was doing some research for a book I have written, I did some research on a particular ancestor whose name's Hongihika, who went to England in 1820. He did this, in fact. And I was listening on the marae to the stories about this ancestor. And the man who was telling the story, the kaumātua, the elder who was telling the story, told the story of Hongihika going to England and wanted to see the king of England. And in order to get to see him, he had to fight a duel. He had to fight with his taiaha, his Māori weapon, against the king's swordsman who had swords. And because he managed to beat them, he could see the king. So this was a story that was told on the marae. Now, as a little white girl here doing my history, who had read about the story of Hongi going to England, I knew that the duel was not true. It did not happen. So, naively, and this is a long time ago, I've learnt, I said to him afterwards, Hongihika did not fight a duel. You know, true story. History, our history is, you know, the true story, it has been documented, he didn't fight a duel. And he took no interest in my account at all. And I learned subsequently as I was thinking about it that history for Pākehā, for me, was finding the truth. What happened? What happened then? What happened then? And writing that down, doing all the research. But for him, as a Māori person telling the story was most important. And the duel, the fight, was representative of Hongihika's bravery and courage and his fortitude. So these things have to sit alongside each other. I can't say, no, that's wrong, because that is, they're two different things. Histories are different. You know, the stories of the past are different. And I had to learn that they just sit there together. Yeah. So that's an example of that kind of cross idea of knowledge.
You said earlier, if I remember correctly, that we are all striving to maximize life. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and what you meant.
well, you know, I think when Māori, I think as Alison said, I mean, I think there's a dominant narrative that, you know, colonised people are just sitting around in their context and then, you know, this wave of colonisation happens to them and they're kind of, in a way, passive in that relationship. And, you know, the history of Māori engagement with the outside world tells a very different story of very active engagement with the outside world. A beckoning and a welcoming in of the outside world to New Zealand, to Aotearoa. And, you know, to the point where Māori were competing with each other to have Europeans come and settle in their communities. That my Pākehā. and why? Because these people are coming with new knowledge, new ideas, new technologies, and this is all to the benefit of the collective and the community. You know, this is, and we're not frightened of it. We're confident in the face of it. We understand ourselves as equal. We don't understand ourselves as less. We made insightful critiques of, you know, European society wherever we went. We were appalled by people getting their hands cut off for being hungry and stealing food, you know. So in our minds, in our ancestors' minds, this was just about engagement and how our lives could be enhanced in every way, socially, you know, theoretically, materially, economically, in all those ways. So that's all I meant. I think I took that phrase from some theorists, I can't remember.
Thank you for taking us on your pathway. I have to say that I understand myself as an ally, but I have a critical question now. You're always talking about Pākehā and Māori. So this seems, as you mentioned, a bicultural system. But I know New Zealand isn't bicultural. It's pluri-ethnical. So what are you establishing now? Is it a hegemonial culture, Maori culture? Or do you take in account as well the Buddhists, Indonesian persons, Chinese persons who migrated to Aotearoa? So, well, it seems to me that this tendency to prioritize Maori culture might be also a danger.
Well, we've nowhere else to be. We've nowhere else in the world where Maori have nowhere else in the world where they belong and can be. So if we can't thrive in our own country, there's nowhere else. So I'd start with that as a response. Yeah, I mean, I understand the question because it's a question often posed to us. I mean, we don't make the kind of laws in New Zealand about how our multi-ethnic or multicultural society has emerged or how it's supported or cared for. And in fact, you know, in times when, you know, we've been, the country has been thinking about taking refugees, or when we had the massacre, for example, a couple of years ago in a mosque in Christchurch, it's Māori who are stepping up and saying, bring these people in, welcome them and look after them. It's really more often the state who's, you know, worrying about what the effects of that will mean. So it's not a zero-sum game, is it? Our return to a healthy state as Māori communities isn't at the expense of others, even though people might argue that. So all these things can and should happen together. And from a cultural point of view, Māori are, you know, absolutely politically fighting for our treaty rights and claiming indigeneity and forms of recognition. And that's what you have to do. That's what you have to do if you want to, you know, thrive. But I don't think we are about doing that at the expense of others. In fact, I think we are the louder voice for others in our nation, louder than any other community. Yeah.
And it is the case, you're absolutely right, about a multi-ethnic society. But I think what we're trying to establish is a treaty-based country so that that multi-ethnicity can thrive underneath the shelter of this relationship between Māori hapū, Māori tribal people, Māori people, and the Crown. And that Crown is increasingly multi, you know, diverse, including with Māori in that space as well. So I think that the distinction is that it's a distinction away from the old idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So diversity is we all treat diverse people in this, we treat them all equally, we include them all in what? The homogenous, dominant culture. It's getting away from that towards the idea of this relational, fundamental relational situation, and then these other things thrive underneath that predominant relationship. Yeah.
But it's not that that relation or the treaty is without question. You know, it's not, I mean, it's hegemonic to a point, but I wouldn't argue that, you know, that's never to be questioned in any way, shape or form, because I think we know what happens when things become so hegemonic, no one can say anything or do anything. So, you know, this is a lively, ongoing and democratic kind of process. Yeah, contested and consensual process that we're in.
And you will know, some of you may know, we're going into another election in next month, and already the election cycle is very live, and these are the sorts of issues that are raised by the right-wing politicians in attempt to slow down or stop this process that is already occurring. I mean, I think things are already moving too fast for the right to dampen them down, but they will try, making all these arguments
divisive
about diversity and about the sameness and we are all one people and all those kinds of arguments. Yeah. So we're political as well as academic activists.
Thank you very much. It's 2:10.
Oh.
Two. Thank you for the discussion. One. I have very many questions still in my mind. I think I'm not the only one, but we all deserve a lunch break, I think. Mm. I would like to repeat what Benjamin said. It is really for us such a gift that you came here. Thank you for your session. I learned a lot. I knew something before, but still I learned a lot, and I think everybody learned a lot. Thank you for coming. Thank you for discussing.